You know, Duncan, I think for a change, would you like to start us off this time? Would you like to cue us into the episode?
As you wish. Hello and welcome, F1, to the Is This Just Fantasy podcast. I'm your host, Duncan Idaho.
And I'm your other host, Jordy Nebraska.
I want to make that joke so much.
And today we are covering Dune by Frank Herbert. On Is This Just Fantasy, every other week, Duncan and I, we get together and we discuss a fantasy novel, but we promise this one, it's a bit touch and go. Some people might be a teeny bit annoyed at me, but according to our very specific and scientific criteria, this is indeed a fantasy
novel. It is. We have talked about this in great depth in the past, but our general rule of thumb for the It's Just Fantasy podcast has always been, if you take that book, it's far in the future, or where it's set, and you just wind the clock back. If you fundamentally get to something that is just completely normal present day, then it's sci-fi. And if not, it's fantasy.
And on the surface, that fits Dune, because all the special things about Dune is that it's set 20,000 years in the future, which is really, really far. That's like several ice ages away. That's ice ages isn't a thing, not ice age movies. I was too distracted by how good that joke was. What was I about to say? Oh, yeah. So on the surface, that's like, yeah, it's sci-fi. It's set in a super-duper future. But if you go even further back than the present day, and you cycle it back, and you read up to, like, the third book in the series, you discover that it is not sci-fi, according to our criteria, because Paul Atreides is descended, like, literally directly ascended from Agamemnon, from the Trojan War. And because, on this podcast, we have decided that the Trojan War is fantasy, so that we can do our number one book, well, tied for number one book, Song of Achilles, yeah.
Now, there is kind of more to it than that. I do think, like, that's our argument. It's the one I kind of agree with, obviously. But reading Dune, if it's sci-fi, well, then it is the softest, lightest, wibbly-wobbly bit of sci-fi I have ever read.
Yeah, psychic powers as a whole are, like, I think they do fall into the sci-fi category, and a lot of the stuff in this book is the same sort of sci-fi stuff that appears in, say, the Assassin's Creed series. It's about, like, genetic memory. But there's a lot of stuff in this book that is just magic. Like, Paul's kind of a wizard. And also, when I was reading this through this time, I was like, how is Jessica transmuting poison into, like, not poison, you know? Like, she's manipulating atoms. But it doesn't. But the Bene Gesserit stuff is like they control stuff that goes inside their bodies, right? How did she transmute it? So yeah, she's a wizard.
All I can think about is that is actually a thing in Star Wars, where I think it's the scene where like Count Dooku can like use the Force to like take apart poisons. So definitely fantasy. And it's, to be honest, I would recommend this to fantasy fans because it has a lot of the structural beats of a kind of classic fantasy work. We've got the young hero who's turfed out of his home by tragic incident. He goes on a journey of discovery and he, you know, rallies the people and overthrows the bad guy.
Yeah, there's an emperor, there are dukes and barons and troubadours. There's a lot of fantastical stuff here.
So, what is Dune? It's the first book by Frank Herbert, I almost said Brian then. That is something to not do. First book by Frank Herbert in his Dune, I don't actually know what the whole series is called, Compendulum series. Do we just call it the series?
Yeah, probably.
What's quite interesting about the first book, despite the fact that there are now somewhere like 24 books in the Dune series as a whole, when this one first came out, and despite what claims have been made, and there's a little bit of George Lucas-fying, I think, going on, this was written and published as a standalone piece of work.
And that checks out. Like, it's obvious that he wanted to go further with it and explore ideas in a way that he would in Dune Messiah and from then on, and the ideas keep getting bigger and bigger. However, the book Dune is pretty open and shut. You do not have to read. You do not have to go on and read the rest of the series. You can be completely content with the story that is told in this.
And what's quite interesting is that's kind of the case, I personally feel, for like the first three sequels as well. Each one has a sense of, I'm putting this out, I might have further ideas, but I'm not counting on ever writing more.
Now, speaking of sequels, Duncan, what is your experience with the sequels? I'll go first. I think I share a very common experience of loving Dune, making my way through Messiah. I have read it a couple of times, and I have never managed to finish Children of Dune.
Wow, okay. I have made it a little bit further than you. So, I love the original Dune. I really love Messiah as well. I think it's like, it feels less of a sequel and more of like the epilogue that the first story needed to like encapsulate the themes. And to be quite honest with you, Geordie, like the closing scene of Messiah, I feel so far, is like the perfect ending.
To the saga as a whole, you feel like the birth of Leto and, what's her name, Ganima?
Oh, Gemima? Don't. I can't do these names. So, it's...
Yeah, I shouldn't have come to you for advice. That was mean of me.
This is a great world where you've got, like, Paul, Jess, Thufia, and, like, Stilgard next to each other. I don't get it.
No. I gotta say, actually, jumping in here, I think some of the naming in Dune is what makes it so wonderful, because you do have all of these crazy names like Fufir Hawat and Stilgar and Thade Ralpha, Sardukar, Padishah Emperor. I mean, that's that's like from Hebrew or whatever, but you get my point. Like, you have these crazy, futuristic, fantastical names, but the main characters, the ones whose names you have to read over and over and over again, are Paul and Jessica, normal names, which my dad can understand. I read through this current reading of Dune, and I think this is my fifth read-through of the book, was done via audiobook. And every other time I've read Dune has been with an audiobook, because I really love the audiobook. It's a long book, it helps me get through it. I only found out, though, apparently there are literal scenes missing, which I did not realize. Like, there's a whole scene of dialogue between Fufir Hawat and Paul that's just not in there, and that concerns me. I feel like I'm not getting my money's worth. But I do own a physical copy, and I wasn't able to read through it this time because I gave it to my dad. My dad decided that he really wanted to get into Dune because of the new movies that had come out, and he wants to see them, but he thinks he should read the book first. And so he's currently reading it, so I cannot use it for reference.
See, at least he has just a single volume to read through. I had to sit down. I have the Great Dune Trilogy in like a massive collection, hardcover. Really difficult to read, to get through. So this was not light reads. I couldn't take it with me to work. And sorry, to spin back round to the series, that's another kind of misnomer. I think it always gets sold as like the Great Dune Trilogy and like the next Great Dune Trilogy for the following six books that Frank Herbert wrote. And that just feels like such a misnomer, because it very much feels, for me reading them and to give my little reviews, Dune, perfect standalone. Dune Messiah, great continuation. Children of Dune, absolutely off the wall. What happened, dear God? And then God Emperor, which I love. Just want to say, God Emperor, I actually is like maybe my second favourite Dune book, because it is so off in its just philosophical musings, and it's so time-wise, so out there from the first three books. You're like, that none of my characters are the same. There's like two people who are still around. Realise, okay, this is different. So those four were all written, but again, feeling very standalone-ish, each one. And then finally, Frank Herbert went, I'm going to write a trilogy. And he planned out three books back to back. He's like, this is going to capstone off my time with the Dune universe. And he wrote Heretics of Dune. And very quickly after that, only a year later, when the average release schedule was about once every 4 to 5 years, wrote the sequel, Chapter House of Dune. And then he sadly passed away before finishing the final book.
How many of those have you read, Duncan?
I have read the first five in their entirety, and I was reading Chapter House.
So that's up to Heretics.
Yep. I have started Chapter House about three times, and I just can't... Mm. And part of the thing is, because I know it doesn't have a full ending, it ends on a cliffhanger. Well, Frank Herbert left it on a cliffhanger. It sort of just felt like I don't need to go forwards. I wasn't a big fan of Heretic. I actually said when I read Heretic for the first time, I was moaning about it continuously to my partner. She was just like, why do you keep reading it? I'm like, because I would hate to be that person that puts the book down on page 300 and then find out that like the last 50 pages are amazing. And I can't believe I said this. The last 50 pages were really amazing. Not worth the effort to get to them. But that had an incredible, like, pull the rug out from under you ending. But then again, it's just a bit harder to get through. I think it's very fair to say that Dune as a franchise for me is something that in general is sort of diminishing returns. I do think the moment you read one and you're like, even though I pushed through Children that I didn't like and enjoyed God Emperor, I do feel like as a general trend, if you read one and go, oh, not for me, maybe you're right leaving it there. And the first four books, you can all do that
with. It's not for everyone. Dune is the most enjoyable and the most accessible, and it's not an accessible book. Because of the movies, there's been a big injection of new fans of Dune who are like, they've seen the films and they either have just started to dabble in the books or they haven't read the books yet. And the films are a really simplified version of the plot of the books. Like, so much stuff is cut out. And it's impressive that it was made as good as it is, considering how hard it would be to adapt Dune. But it's like the J.J. Abrams Star Trek. Like, it's a brighter, flashier, dumber version of the original. And people still come away with, like, loads of questions about, like, why did characters do this? Why couldn't characters do that? Why would the jihad work? Like, surely they're gonna lose. And it's completely understandable to have these questions because, yeah, it's not obvious in a way that a lot of other books are.
I'll tell you now, Geordie, I still don't fully understand what the Golden Path was. And I've read up to 5 books in this series. It has some really dense ideas. And I think for anyone coming in, as I said, we're talking about this book series because, and Dune today, because it is popular and it is a tentpole of the fantasy, science fantasy genre.
Mm.
But it is dense. I said to you earlier in the week, Geordie, well, Dune's a bit of a beast to get through. It's enjoyable, but this is nowhere near the most accessible book. In fact, it kind of shocked me that the page count is very similar to Empire of the Damned. And Empire of the Damned, you can fly through.
Yeah, a book which flies by.
This doesn't. It's worth it for me, but it does take just a little bit more on the reader's behalf to kind of just mine it out.
Actually, you say that, but now this is an anecdote. My girlfriend, she was speaking to a colleague. I guess this was about 2 months ago now. She was speaking to a colleague after she and I went to see Dune Part 2, which we both enjoyed. And she was telling her colleague about it, who said, I've been in a bit of a slump. What's Dune like? And she said, oh, the movie was good. Have you read the books? And she said, I didn't know it was a book. And then the next day, or a couple of days later, she spoke to her friend. And she said, yeah, I really enjoyed Dune. And she said, oh, you went to see it? No, I read it. I'm actually halfway through Children of Dune now. She had flown through all of Dune Messiah, and was partway through Children of Dune in just like a week.
Wow, that's impressive. I think that's just all you can kind of say to that is everyone is different, and it is unfair of me to say, you know, will you fly through this? Will you just pick up? Some people will, some people won't. I'm just saying, I think on the spectrum of literature, I would just put Dune a little bit further along on there. Either ask a bit more of you or throw so much at you. And this, I think, is a common kind of misnomer. There's plenty in Dune, which it doesn't expect you, the reader, to perfectly understand when it first gets introduced.
No, it just says stuff like Chome, for example. Chome is mentioned and you're just expected to be confident enough as a reader to say, okay, I don't know what that is. I'm just going to wait, and later I think it will become apparent. So you need to have that headspace, like, maybe you don't know what a mentat is. Well, at some point you will. So just remember that mentats exist, and at some point they'll be explained.
So, Geordie, I take it you like the book.
Oh yeah, I love this book. It was actually the very first book I ever got on Audible, because I knew that I'd need help to get through it. I had a physical copy of the book. I think my dad got it for me when I was about 14 years old, and I dropped it for the most superficial of reasons, which was that I was reading through chapter 1, and when I found out that Paul was, like, the only man to ever master an art which only women could do, I was like, ugh, come on. What is this fucking Gary Stu shit? And I dropped the book.
I mean, to be fair, if you want to throw like the Gary Stu kind of connotations around at Paul, there's certainly an argument there. I'm not gonna...
Oh yeah, this dude is straight Ichigoing. He's got Mentat powers, so he's a human computer. He's a master duelist. He's the only boy in the entire sisterhood of the Bene Gesserit, and he can do all of their powers, like mind reading. Well, not mind reading, but extremely up close and personal body language detection, just like everyone on TikTok. He can control you with mind control. He can do magic kung fu. He can see the future because he's also kind of a guild navigator.
And I think maybe much the testament to the Dune books is getting that main character and just adding and adding until they just get so unrelatable. They need to bring in a new character for you to go, okay, I'm grounded again now. Thank you. They're too godlike. I can't empathize anymore.
And it says a lot that despite all of that being the case, it's such an engaging and interesting book that you don't care about how anything as superficial as that. That's so unimportant compared to the sense of gravitas that the rest of the book has and the depth of the characters. Something I find really interesting about Dune is how it utilizes the omniscient narrator. In any given scene, we're allowed to pop between people's heads. There's never a single point of view character. In a conversation between Peter DeVries. In a conversation between Peter DeVries and Baron Harkonnen, who are talking next to a tied up Lady Jessica, you fly back and forth through all of their heads. You get to see what Pataya is thinking and what Harkonnen is scheming about, and Jessica, who's reading both of them, and she's providing a sort of commentary on it, which means that there's an immense, immense sense of depth to what characters choose to say to each other, and an immense sense of cunning. Guile and political cunning are so instrumental to this book and what makes it great. You constantly have a sense that people are thinking 10 steps ahead and that everyone around is basically trying to out-genius each other.
You certainly do. I think there's a particular scene between Lady Jessica and the character of Thufir Hawat where I really felt that for the first time and came to that kind of realisation, is that what's so enjoyable in a lot of these conversations is that you're seeing the chess be played out. And I love it when you get in that, as you mentioned, that kind of that perfect little microcosm of you'll be given what the character thinks and then you'll immediately get a slightly contradictory bit of speech and you'll go, okay, I see what game you're playing. Very fun. And you talk about that omniscience. That's something that I really noticed on this reread of Dune for me, where I kind of noticed how much information, not like necessarily world building, basically I'm talking about Dr. Yuet. Where that's laid in is something where you're just told, this guy, he's a wrong'un. And then you're like, okay, thank you. What? Who told me that? The narrator's told me that. Okay, cool. I need to know. Thank you.
Yeah, you're presented with a ton of information up close, right from the start. The first chapter is Paul meeting with the Reverend Mother. And then chapter 2 introduces us to our villains. And the villains lay out the entire scheme. They tell us everything that's going to happen. And that should be really boring, waiting for the shoe to drop. But actually, the first third, or not even a third, I think the first half of the book is just the breakdown of House Atreides. And you're constantly thinking, like, can they detect the problem? Can they come up with a counter solution? But the sense of doom is laid in right from the start. When Reverend Mother Helen Mohayam, no, Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohayam, these names, I mean, come on. When she shows up, she's talking to Paul about how his father is doomed, and it's like, everyone knows this. It is written. There's nothing that can be done to prevent this.
But that kind of establishes one of the central themes of, can you buck destiny? And particularly when Paul gets the powers of presence later down the line, that becomes a core theme for the entire book series. You know, is it all written? what can we do to escape our fate? And I'm really glad that it's kind of built into the first half of this book by telling us this is what's awaiting the Atreides. And then you get this, Dune kicks off with you realizing that you can't escape your fate. That's the example. And then the rest of the series is building on what do you have to do to actually manage it and can it be done? And Jordi, I know we've like flown over the book. I'm really having to just assume when people are listening to this particular episode that you will have a at least the film level familiarity with the world of Dune. Because there is just so much here. I couldn't really even begin to be like, and now we met the Fremen. This is their backstory. Because I know it. I know I could, I have the 100,000 years of the Fremen history knocking about my brain. And you're like, now's not the time to recount the desert dwellers. Let's go.
Yeah, I do think there is something. I think there's definitely a conversation we can have in this episode about the Fremen and their depiction, because I think there's some really interesting push and pull between the way in which Frank Herbert writes about colonialism and decolonialism in regard to these space Arabs. And I think it's a really interesting and nuanced discussion you can have about what is the depiction like? Is it a positive one? Is it racist? Is it anti-racist? I'm not, like, it's hard to say.
Okay, so then let's just say then we are like 20 minutes in here. Let's lay out Dune in a very simple way. Dune.
Arrakis.
Desert planet.
We were both doing it.
This is the story of political movements in a far distant future empire of the human race originating on Earth, so far in the future that humanity's origins are kind of lost in the mystique of time. And into this world we're following Paul, the heir to the Atreides family, the dukedom, and they have been gifted by the emperor in all his generosity the planet Dune, which is the single source of the magic space dust that makes the whole empire turn. And then from that opening we discover, as Jordi alluded to, that the evil mechanisms at the play and that their arch enemies, the Harkonnen, are scheming with the Emperor to destroy the Atreides and seize more power within the Empire. Paul and his mother Jessica escape the fall of the Axe and flee into the deserts of Dune, where they meet the local Fremen and cultivate a rebellion and revolt to take Paul personal revenge and avenge his own father, and for the Fremen to free themselves from the colonial yoke that is basically taken over and extracting all the resource from their home planet.
Duncan, I think that was genuinely an impressively concise breakdown of Dune. And in the simplest terms, that's absolutely true. There's a lot of places you can go into more detail, and we shall. But that's long and short of it. In a lot of ways, this is a straightforward heroic story, right? You've got a boy with special powers. He's just 15. He comes into his own. He's a literal chosen one. He is the Kwisatz Haderach, another wonderful word he invented. And at the end, he marries the princess and he becomes king. What a straightforward heroic story.
And on the surface, not only that, it has some very, on the absolute thinnest surface, people, it has some very classic good guy, bad guys. The Harkonnen are just evil. The Atreides, they are just good. And they're going to fight it out.
There is something really wonderful about how the way the story balances these almost comically evil bad guys with the rest of the political nuance in the story. Everything else that happens is due to geopolitical pressures and socioeconomic factors. But the Harkonnens, as you've said, Duncan, they're kind of just wrongins. They're just really bad. And that's really, like, it's welcome. It's fun to see how villainously, you know, mustache-twirling Count Vladimir Harkonnen can be and Fade Ralpher, and see them scheming against each other. It genuinely is a breath of fresh air to see an uncle and a nephew just try and murder each other, the way God intended.
I mean, yes, it is. And I think it really speaks, though, to the fact that Dune balances such deep complexity with some simple truths that it's very easy for a new reader to cling on to. Like you said, you read the first two chapters and you go, who's my hero? Paul, the young chosen one. Who are the villains? The evil Vladimir Harkonnen. Cool. Perfect. I can follow that. and I can follow this hero's journey of self-discovery, of betterment, and of clear motivations. What does Paul want? He wants to get revenge on those that betrayed his family. Well, not those that betrayed his family, those that actively attacked his family. Yeah, betrayed, in a way. A very roundabout political circle of betrayal.
Yeah, and that's absolutely. Well. And then you can go one step deeper and you say, hang on, maybe this is like doing a dark inversion of a heroic story, because Paul isn't just the chosen one because he's the Kwisatz Haderach. He's the chosen one because the people of Fremen believe that he is both the Mahdi and the Lisan al-Ghaib, that he's this prophesized chosen one who's going to come and liberate them. And his victory not only sees him take the imperial throne, it also sees him unleash the Fremen on the universe in a jihad, a word which you'll notice was not included in the 2021 and 2024 releases.
No, in fact, I believe in the trailer for the first movie, they even used the word crusade instead at one point. I'm like, oh, you're not sticking to the guns.
Yeah, hang on. I mean, I understand. Like, a lot of the stuff in the movies is just toned down a little bit. You could even go as far as to say wimped out in terms of, like, making statements about... I mean, it's definitely still a criticism of religion and charismatic leadership. That's definitely intact. He's managed to maintain that. But it is a lot simpler. You know, when it comes to, like, the Spacing Guild is hardly ever mentioned. That's really important to the books, and they're just not around. Duncan, what is a Spacing Guild?
Oh, God, Geordie. What more world building? The Spacing Guild, they hold a monopoly on intergalactic travel. This isn't Star Wars. You don't have smugglers hopping in their Millennium Falcons. The Spacing Guild drive massive, like, cruisers, which, if you're rich enough, you get to put your little ship inside when they stop off, and then you get to travel with them. And they need, they're the only ones who can utilize the spice from Arrakis to actually travel through space.
And why is that, Duncan? Is that because they can bend space using spice?
No, the ship's engines can bend space. What they need is the spice for their navigators to take so that they can see sort of a level of presence to basically see through space and time in order to maneuver the ship safely. It's sort of like in how Star Wars, you can't just jump to light speeds without precise coordinates. You're like ricochet off a star. It's like they don't have precise coordinates. They just need to have just enough presence just to dodge things as they careen at super light speed through the galaxy.
They plot in a course, and then their prescience goes, wrong choice. And they say, okay, I'll start again. How about this one? Okay, how about this one? Ding!
And it kind of leads into these multiple layers that go on above the planet Arrakis, which is Dune, where you've got the Spacing Guild, you've got the power of the Mentats, who are the human supercomputers, where they've taken people and drugged them up so that they can run great calculations in their heads. You've got Chome, which is essentially, I'm going to call the stock market.
Yeah, it really is. It's literally the stock
market. Brilliant.
It's shareholders. Like, the noble houses represent shareholders in Chome, which is, like, the only business in town. And the Emperor is just, like, the head of the board.
And then, likewise, you've got the great houses, who have, like, regional complete authoritarianism. But, as we said, power is relative on a galactic scale. If you're not in with the guild, and you don't have a share in spice production, then... that's all you have. You have your one little planet. You're not a galactic player.
Which means that when Atreides or House Harkonnen get control of Arrakis, they have control over the most important resource in the entire universe.
And that is?
It's the thing that makes travel between planets possible. Without it, they'd be back in the galactic stone age.
Effectively. And that is obviously the spice melange, which I don't think I used that word yet, which... is vaguely described as having a cinnamon-y smell to it. It's just nice to think about.
Yeah. Except it's the funny thing about it is great that it's a spice because it's spicy and it smells and tastes like cinnamon. But it's not spice. It is worm something. Even I'm not really sure what it is. I think it's like the stuff worms leave behind so they can lay little worms in, right?
I mean, I'm glad that we've just finally gotten a mere 30 minutes in and now we mention the sandworms.
Oh yeah, the most iconic thing from Dune.
Yes, it's the sandworms are native only to Arrakis. They produce it as a side effect. They excrete it. Let's use that word.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I believe it's so unique here is the fact that worms, basically, any level of water is poison to them and will kill them off instantly. And I mean levels like in the air itself. And Arrakis is the only place just bone dry enough that allows these things to exist. Do you like the worms?
I love the worms. The worms are really fascinating. I know they go so much deeper. I haven't gotten to the bit in Children of Dune where they explain like what they are and why they're important. But the worms and the ecology of Arrakis is probably the most interesting part because of the way it impacts on the rest of the series. Like, Arrakis is this planet with no free-flowing water. It's so inhospitable and dry that the people who live there invariably become fanatics because only someone who is a fanatic could survive mentally on Dune. You know, they say, Paul says twice in the book, once via Princess Irulan and once in dialogue himself, God created Arrakis to train the faithful because it's this breeding ground for... It invariably will create the people who will do the jihad because you cannot live somewhere like that without believing that there's something divine about the place. Otherwise, you just leave.
Yes, and the visuals of the worm in Arrakis, I love the new movies. I even really like the old, 1980s Lynch film, purely because the worm effects in that, I just like have such a kind of majesty to them. It's absolutely fantastic. And I do enjoy the way that these creatures are built up. And I don't want to actually throw out spoilers now. And I was on the cusp of doing so for Children's Dune.
Oh.
But
fair enough.
Being this sort of return point of what the worms are and what they represent. And kind of fluttering between the idea that they are actually just creatures getting on with their lives.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you can't worship them.
Yes. Great Shai Hulud, the maker. Bless the maker and his water.
Is a really nice element and something where, like we keep saying, there's a lot of kind of conversations in this book about religion and religion's role.
Yes.
Geordie, I think we need to grab the bull by the tail here. No, the horns. Tail will be a very different scenario. Grab it by the horns. Geordie, what do you think Dune is trying to say about religion and messiah figures?
So, it's definitely anti-messiah figures. I said recently that when we were reviewing Empire of the Vampire, that the atheist language in that book is kind of juvenile. You know, it's kind of the sort of arguments you make against believing in God when you're 15. And it was making a book that was not written for 15-year-olds. But then afterwards, I was thinking to myself, like, well, but what is the right way to write about religion, like, and write an atheist book? Like, how do you write in a less juvenile manner? And the answer to that is Dune. It's show, don't tell. Why is believing in a messiah bad? Well, Paul's going to be a messiah, and he's going to unleash a jihad that will kill 61 billion people. And he's going to try and control that. But he can't, because once he gets that ball rolling, there's no stopping it. And he didn't even invent the myth, because it was invented by the Bene Gesserit as part of their Missionaria Protectiva, which heralded the coming of the Kwisatz Haderach on Arrakis by telling them that he was going to be the Lisan al-Gaib. And when he arrives, now this is something really interesting I learned in researching before this episode. So, Duncan, actually, a side note. Something that's really interesting I've noticed, after watching Dune Part 2, they talk about the Lisan al-Gaib in Dune Part 2 way more than they do in the book. It's a phrase that's thrown around a lot, but most of the time people refer to Paul just by name. They call him Muad'Dib. When they cheer for him, they say Muad'Dib or Paul Muad'Dib. It's only occasionally that people break out Lisan al-Ghaib, but they constantly chant it in Dune Part 2. And in the way people talk about Dune Part 2 online, people are constantly talking about the Lisan al-Ghaib. And I've noticed, in fact, amongst fans of the movie exclusively who haven't read the book, they don't know the word Kwisatz Haderach.
That
they never talk about it.
Is such a key point. And that was something that I felt when I watched the second movie, because to me, the Kwisatz Haderach is the word. If I had to say, what is Paul, or what is he pretending to be, I would say the Kwisatz Haderach. Mm.
Well, I'd say he is the Kwisatz Haderach, and he's pretending to be a messiah. But yes, I see your point.
Yes, and they really go hard on that bit of language. What do you reckon, why? Why do you think that is?
Legitimately, I'm not sure. I'm not sure, because they're not using the word jihad, because they're worried about it offending people, but they're also using the more Arabic term to refer to him, as the space Arabs are chanting for a jihad. So it's weird. I feel like maybe it's like he got studio notes saying, you can't use the word jihad. And so Dennis said, okay, well, if I can't use the word jihad, then I'm going to really amp up the use of the phrase Lisan al-Ghaib to try and give the same sense without saying it. Actually, now that I say it out loud, that feels really plausible.
That certainly is where I would go. It's like, it's the middle ground, so that people maybe who somehow miss that the Fremen are meant to be space Arabs, can pick up on that a little bit more.
To be fair, in a movie, there are not a lot of Arabic actors amongst them. They're mostly either black or Mexican. What's the main guy again? What's Stilgar? I've forgotten his name. What's his name?
Just looking it up.
Javier Bardem. Javier Bardem is... Oh, he's Spanish. He's just Spanish.
That's a good point, and I don't want to dive too much into the casting of the film. So, let's then just bring it back. As you said, this is a really good, intelligent way of showing a more anti-religious message. Because what it essentially does, it's taking what a lot of maybe more atheist views would accuse of religion, and then creating this fictional religion and then fully pulling back the curtain. Being like, look, they're believing it, and here are the people pulling the strings. In fact, they're some of our main characters.
Exactly.
We know for a fact, and it completely loses the ambiguity. It sort of says, look, in this world, completely and concretely, this has been made up, but to the people down on Arrakis, that doesn't make a lick of difference. They're behaving like it's real. And then you can sit there and make that inference that just because people treat it like it's real, this is what Frank Herbert's doing, doesn't actually mean a lick compared to whether or not it is or not.
The question of why can't Paul stop the jihad is a very common one amongst fans of Dune, because it is really hard to answer, because you feel like, of course he should be able to do it. He's the leader. He can just say, stop doing the jihad. But it's so interesting, the fact that he never comes up with a reason why Paul can't say that. He just takes it as a given that no, he can't do it. Like, he just, once that ball's rolling, there's no stopping it.
So I think there's kind of two ways you can kind of argue this. On the first hand, you do need to just say, well, Frank Herbert's universe and Paul himself has presense. So you could say, well, it's not talking about every case. It's just that I, as the author, has said in this world, he can't stop it. And Paul, as a character who can see the future, knows that. So just accept what I've put on the table.
I think I was really tuned into that this time. And I was trying to really pinpoint, because the movie is really stark and black and white on this. He drinks the water of life. And then he's like, fuck yes, I don't care anymore, do it. He has like a moment of like, sigh, I guess I gotta do a jihad. But they invent a new reason for it that kind of feels like they're justifying it and dumbing it down a little bit by saying the noble houses won't accept you. And it is a really dumbed down version, because it completely takes away from the message of the entire movie
Geordi, I'm just kind of coiling up into a ball here, like a coil spring, and I just want to like blurt out a bit of information.
Okay.
I'm just going to put like a minor. If you're listening to this and you've got your phone, just either mute me for like 30 seconds or hit forward or whatever. Okay, a bit of future context. So a bit of context of the future books, Geordi, is that Paul can't stop the jihad. He can't, because if he does, the long-term consequences would be so catastrophically worse.
Yeah, man, I know about the golden path, like, but Paul doesn't talk about the golden path in this
book. Because it clearly Frank Herbert hadn't come up with it yet. Classic.
Yeah, he needed to justify it. I've read enough of it. I've gotten to the point where, you know, if I read a little bit further in Children of Dune, Paul and Leto are going to have to say, like, you got to become a worm. I wasn't brave enough to do it, but you can, or whatever. So that you can enslave humanity and make them whatever. I get it. But throughout the entire book, what Paul wants to do is stop the jihad. And at a certain point, he just doesn't care anymore. And he's just, let's do it. I can't stop it, so I'm just going to let it rip. Unleash them. I don't care anymore.
And I suppose the element there is he kind of realised he can't have his cake and eat it too. He can't get his revenge. He can't overthrow the Harkonnen and put himself on the throne without unleashing the jihad. And he goes, price worth paying. Onwards. At least that's how I read it in the first book alone.
That's what I thought as well, but I was reading through this time, and I think that Frank Herbert is still playing a little bit more of a softball, because he says to himself that, like, it basically doesn't matter if he takes a throne or not, or if he gets revenge or not. The jihad is inevitable anyway, because the Fremen control the spice, and he has made enough of an impact on them already, and they believe in him enough already, that even if he dies, he will become a martyr. And the jihad would continue anyway. There's nothing to be done. And I think basically what comes down to is that, like, I reckon Paul could have stopped the jihad if he had, like, made the decision early enough. Like, before he met up with Stilgar, or even after that. Like, even after finding Stilgar, but before he, like, became renowned throughout the Fremen groups in the various sieges. I reckon he could have done it. By just wandering into the desert, letting a worm eat him, being forgotten. I think he could have gotten away with it. But by the time he has improved his powers of prescience enough to see the full scope, to get a really clear view of the future, then it's too late. They believe he's the Lisan al-Gaib. They already have a plan to throw off the Harkonnens and take control of Arrakis. He just happens to be the person who leads them to do that. But they were going to do it anyway.
Something that I noticed on this reread is that I actually found Paul, in terms of characterization, a bit different to how I remember. I remember finishing the first part of this book and getting right near the end where he sort of declares himself Mor Dib. And this was my memory getting a bit confused with the film, because he picks up a lot later. And I did definitely get a vibe of a much more self-assured and confident individual. The way at the end of the first section of the book, he... Yes?
Go ahead.
The way he talks about, like, his father's mistakes, and he's having his little rant at his mother, and the reveal about her parentage, I think I found him a little bit more like, even if it's not true confidence, a little bit more like, right, I am going to go and be this.
That's what you remembered, but that wasn't your experience this time.
No, that was more my experience this time. I think I found him a bit more self-confident than I remember.
Oh, interesting. I would say that in that particular scene, yes, there's a lot of, like, righteous anger, and he is determined to get revenge, and he makes that decision at that point. I definitely agree with you there. It's all the stuff that comes later where I think when he's struggling with his prescience and he can't tell past from future and stuff like that, that's when he's a lot more doubtful.
I think that's a fair assessment. It's like he's that start of the journey is with confidence. Well, exactly as you said, you know, he gets that prescience and he gets that realization just a little too late. He'd already blundered into the china shop as the bull, smashed enough up, and he's gone, oh dear, what have I done? It's really, well done. And it's a beautiful example. Loads of people, very common rhetoric, is about, I don't want to be told what to think, you know, just let me come to it on my own. I think Frank Herbert does a really nice job in Dune by not too explicitly telling you something, but laying out his story in such a way where you're going to get to the conclusion he wants you to. You're going to think he got there on its own, but he's done a really nice job of like, look, this is my message. I'm not going to put it in exact words, but you should definitely get here, hopefully, by the time you finish my book.
Jumping back to something I was sort of partway through saying, and then we got distracted. The thing which I found out whilst doing research for this, and I found this really interesting because I had no idea about this, the really important phrase, Lisan al-Ghaib is translated in this book because it's so far in the future as the voice from the outer world. Apparently it's more like the tongue of the unknown, but you can see that it's like he's deliberately done like cultural drift. But a phrase which has survived is the word Mahdi. Duncan, do you know what Mahdi means in Islam?
No clue.
Okay, so this is really interesting. It basically has like two important meanings for the reader of Dunes, because he was writing for, what year did this come out? 1967?
65.
Okay, so it comes out in 1965. And he's basically, and he's a journalist. Like, my understanding is that he was basically supposed to write a newspaper article about, like, about Bedouin tribes in the Middle East. And instead, he was like, I did a bunch of research on them. And then I accidentally wrote one of the greatest science fantasy books of all time. Oops. But anyway, so Mahdi is one thing, a very important figure in the religion of Islam. The Mahdi is a figure who will come in the end times. He will come forth along with Jesus to signal the end of the world, basically. And it's this important figure of like religious end times. But it's also a very important phrase in history. And when people are calling Paul the Mahdi, a phrase which is pretty absent from Dune Part 1, I noticed on a rewatch. Before this episode, I rewatched all three Dune movies to prepare. Dune Part 1, Dune Part 2, and Lawrence of Arabia.
I really thought you were going to say the 80s one then. I was so prepared, like, thank God.
No. I've never seen it and I never will, but I watched Lawrence of Arabia for this to get ready. But the Mahdi is a phrase that was involved in the Mahdist War from 1881 to 1899. And basically, there was a guy called Muhammad Ahmed bin Abdullah. He declared himself the Mahdi, and he led like a revolt against the British. So he is this revolutionary figure who used religion to rise up against colonizers. And, you know, Frank, sorry, I got confused. I doubted myself, and then I doubted my doubting of myself, but I should have doubted myself properly.
Can I just drop in here?
Frank Herbert.
Brian's his son. We're not just pulling a random name out of the world.
We'll talk about Brian later. All right. Frank clearly was very influenced by actual history and brought it up to inspire his books, because it's very coherent and based on like stuff that exists. And also, this is really interesting, I have found this out just by coincidence this week, but basically there is a prophecy of the end times in Islam that says like the Arabic deserts will turn green in preparation for the end times. And what is Paul doing with the Fremen? He's trying to turn Arrakis, the deserts, green. And that kind of signals the end times, right? That's where I've gone to in Children of Dune, is the sandworms are dying because they've added a bunch of moisture to the atmosphere.
I mean, exactly. That is, it's this idea of by trying to create paradise, he's actually destroying the very foundations of this empire. I mean, I didn't know that context, and it makes perfect sense that that would be where Frank Herbert was pulling from, because all the other inferences are so clearly there. I don't want to say that Dune, by the way, is necessarily the best voice on the complex real world matters. Like, it's pulling a lot of influence.
Yeah,
but I would hate for someone to walk away and think, gosh, I now understand the real world Middle East so much better because of Dune.
Yeah. We should definitely try and find some books, some fantasy novels out there that are written by, you know, authors from the Middle East, from North African descent, stuff like that, to see how they sprinkle in fantastical elements. I tried to do that. I read a book 2 years ago because I was like, we should do this for the podcast to try and get that North African, Middle Eastern authorial perspective. In fact, I did it twice and both books sucked. So I'm still looking.
I mean, fair enough. And I think that's a real shame. I would love to read something that's actually coming from the culture. Because ultimately, Frank Herbert, it's still...
City of Brass, it's on the list.
It's still that outsider's perspective. I think what you need to view Dune as is not a direct allegory for how you should think about the real world Middle East, but simply appreciate that they've used the real world Middle East as a basis to deliver this different message, which is still valid in itself and interesting and a wonderful book to read. But it's more of a, he's taken that as a template and then written on it, not that this is some lens into the real world.
Yeah. He found out about this thing called a holy war that just happens to be called a jihad and was like, that's really great. I'm going to... Well, probably didn't say that was great, but what he said was, I can utilize that in my novel to be this force of religion going out and purging people. Not realizing that in 30, 40 years, the term jihad would become like really important to actual real world politics. And on the subject of allegory, a lot of people want to say spice is oil. And that's understandable in a lot of ways because it is like the most important substance in the universe and it happens to be largely in control of like the Arabic states. But people, like a lot of allegories, will take it too far. Because the spice is not oil. The spice is everything that is essential for society to function.
Yes, I think that's the thing. It's to say it's oil is to just lay it on our society right now. It's much better to just say it is whatever the requirement is. And I think that's good. Just always bear in mind that, you know, if it becomes a nuclear power or it's the food supply... And I think what's...
Or it's coal back in the 1800s.
Exactly. And I think what's also really nice about the spice is that it's not, unlike oil, it's not a direct fuel. It's only valued in terms of what humans can actually consume of it.
And it can do a lot.
That's where the real fantasy elements comes in. It's like, you can see the future, live longer, run faster.
Become a computer.
Exactly. Jordi, I can't believe we've gone this far. We haven't even talked about some amazing world building in Dune. We've talked about the Mentats.
There's just too much of it. There's just too much of
it. Well, I just want to throw out there, I love the idea of a fantasy, science fantasy setting where we're like post... I always at one point thought Dune was like post-apocalypse. Like, there has been the Matrix in Dune in the past. We've been enslaved by machines and that they call them thinking machines and like overthrown them, beaten the robots, and now we're a couple... 10,000-20,000 years out after that.
That's super cool. Are there any books about that?
Yes, there are, Geordi. Written by Brian Herbert. Evan J. Anderson.
I bet they're great.
They are... That's a complete sentence. They are... books.
They are. That's true. They think, and therefore they are.
So...
Are they good?
I won't pass judgment because I haven't actually read them. I've only read the first in the House trilogy.
That's not what you told me.
By...
Oh, right. You haven't read the Robot Wars one. You've just read the House Carino one or whatever.
Yes. So, after the Frank Herbert's untimely death and the fact that he left his series unfinished, Brian Herbert, his son, in a very Christopher Tolkien way, gathered up all the notes and went, okay... I'm going to try and continue my father's work and give him an ending. And he teamed up with established science fiction author Kevin J. Anderson, who I've only ever other books I've read is his Star Wars books, and they're not held as the best of them. And they have written, since Frank Herbert's passing, somewhere in the vicinity of 18 Dune books. They have gone back in time, forward in time, midquels. They have layered on full-on spin-offs. They have layered on into this world and written a lot of content. The main thing that you sort of would need to know about Little D is that they, as a writing duo, make very little attempt, to no attempt, to emulate the voice and prose of Frank Herbert.
Yes, I have observed that. I was in Forbidden Planet the other day, a sentence I've said in the last 3 podcast episodes, and I picked up the latest book. I think it's Princesses of Dune, which is about Princess Irulan and Chaney. I picked it up and I read it through and I was like, what the fuck is this? I didn't read enough to make a judgment on whether it's good or bad or not, but it's just not Dune. It's just desert sci-fi adventure.
It certainly, in many respects, you could argue is a bit, they tend to be, the what I read of House Atreides, the first in the Prelude series, faster paced, lot more action, different point of views. It feels more like just that cheaper, faster fiction. It is expanding on the lore. To be honest, the best way to compare it, not the best way, one way to compare it, is to look at something like Kim J. Anderson. He wrote Star Wars Expanded EU. You know, so he's taking something that's established, that has lore, that has characters, that is beloved, and he cranked out some fiction that is technically in that world.
The question is...
Good for you.
You made the very understandable comparison to Christopher Tolkien. Christopher Tolkien is this fascinating figure in the world of fantasy because, to my understanding, he's not, you could argue, he's not a writer per se. He's more of a compiler. His father wrote many of the notes and the ideas, and he has later gone on and he's put them together. Now, this is still a very creative endeavor because he's had to decide how to sell a tape and how to rewrite things to make them fit together. I'm holding in my hand now my copy of A Silmarillion. It says J.R.R. Tolkien in big text, and it says edited by Christopher Tolkien. But to my understanding, hearing the way other people who are more adept Tolkien scholars than I am, he's still very important creative voice in this because he's made an important decision about what to cut down, what to trim. There's a reason why there's a chapter in this book, The Silmarillion, about the fall of Gondolin, and there's a book about the fall of Gondolin, which has like 5 different versions of the same story in it. And I think it's really telling that Christopher Tolkien has, over the past several decades, written about 5 different books breaking down the storytelling process and the different drafts of his father's unfinished tales, and has turned them into these, not even novels, these not almost non-fiction works, because they're mostly about the his father's process and the origin points of these stories, like how The Fall of Gondolin was like written in the hospital after his father was wounded at the Battle of the Somme. And then there's Brian Herbert, who has made 18 books teaming up with a sci-fi novelist who writes Star Wars books to make money. I know I'm coming at this from a judgmental point, but to my understanding, Duncan, his job was to finish the series because there was one book left to write, right?
Yes, by Frank Herbert's original plan, he had one more book ready to go, or what he was in process.
And how long did it take him to write that book?
Oh, I love how you assume it. He just wrote it as one book. No, so it took him... he wrote the Prelude trilogy first, the House trilogy, and then would have been the final book in the original series, he split into 2 novels, I believe. I'm going to say it was like Hunters of Dune and Sandworms of Dune. But I may be getting that a little wrong.
I'm not going to correct you.
Okay, I think there's kind of several ways you can look at this. Oh, I did get that right. It was Hunters and Sandworms. And by the way, he put them out. So the last one written by Frank, K. came out in 85. It was a full 14 years until we got a new Book in the Dune series by Brian Herbert in 1999.
As in, that's when he did the House trilogy or when he did Hunters of Dune?
That's when he did the House trilogy. And I believe I've gotten this wrong. He actually wrote the House trilogy and the Distant Past trilogy before he wrote Hunters of Dune and Sandwares of Dune.
So he wrote six books in between finishing his father's work.
Yes, you could argue it's the equivalent of going, if Return of the King isn't out, I know what I'll do. I'll just do some Silmarillion first because they'll want that context and then I'll hit them with Return of the King.
But the question is, Duncan, did Frank want to write the prequels? Like, did he want to write about Robot Wars?
I would have to say that if Frank Herbert wanted to write about the prequels, Frank Herbert would have written about the prequels. Probably. He had many a year, and the fact that he was focused, and he said that, you know, this is my last one. That was sort of the line from Frank Herbert. I have notes, I have ideas, but this is the book I want to put out. It goes right back to the original Dune. He put it out and to function on its own. He had loads of ideas. And in fact, Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson did put out one book in that sort of... this is a collection of short stories, not short stories, fragments and drafts vein to give you an idea about how the writing process happened. It was called The Road to Dune, which I do have and have read. And it's very interesting, and you see the early draft of Dune as just desert planet and the characters being a bit different. I think in the early version there was a romance between Duncan and Jessica.
Understandable. Everyone finds Duncan very sexy, just like on this podcast.
Thank you. So he did do that. I think it's so hard because I don't know. This is actually a very personal relationship between a father and son. Maybe, you know, we don't know. It could have been his dad's, like, dying wish to see this finished. And also, Brian Herbert with Kevin J. Anderson, they have written so much in terms of word count, Dune at this point. It almost feels like he is the greater contributor to the universe. You know, it's like you've got Frank Herbert's universe of the nucleus, and he's created this whole expanded one around it. Again, going back to a comparison.
Or you could argue that what was once a cohesive, streamlined series is now a much more bloated franchise.
I would refer to you to the people who would say that any Star Wars not directly from the mind of George Lucas, like, is it really canon Star Wars?
I don't think that's comparable at all, because Dune is, like, really good art, and Star Wars is, like, three good movies.
That's one more than I would have given it. That's a lie, I love them. Fair enough. I think what works, though, and why I can certainly see why I get the tone, you know, you're a bit upset about how the series has been pulled upon and expanded on over the time. I would just say is that Frank Herbert, other than the last two books, wrote in such a way that it functions on its own, so you don't need to worry. If you want to ignore the expanded Dune universe and just read Frank Herbert's core works, you really can, and many people do.
Dune itself, it's an amazing book. Wow, I was about to wrap up, but we actually have like ages left. We're only at 70 minutes.
I know, I feel like we're going to have to touch on something else and go back in, because there's so much we've faced by going to like overview. We only deep dived on one theme, which is Messiah and religion.
All right, back to Dune. Duncan, is there anything else you want to cover?
Yes, I want to cover the second protagonist of this book, because I want to call them that, and that's the character of Lady Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
This is an amazingly written character, and also a rare one in a lot of fantasy literature. How often do we see such strong, dynamic, I want to call her like a mother figure, but she's so much more than that.
The mother figure in particular is very unique. There's lots of strong women in fantasy. There's not a lot of strong mothers.
And to have a character that is both strong in the way she is a mother, strong besides, not besides, but in external ways to just her role as a mother, and occupies so many different roles throughout the story. So Lady Jessica is Paul's mother. Shock. She's also a member of the Sisterhood of the Bene Gesserit, one of the, really, I think, the cornerstones of the Dune universe. Next to Spice and the Fremen, they are the other side of the board. To be honest, they are the other side. I say the other side of the board. Maybe they're not. Maybe the Fremens are the pawns out front and they're the players. But
we also control House Carino. Like, as dangerous as the Emperor is and as dangerous as the Sardaukar are, the Emperor is completely manipulated by the Bene Gesserit and his truthsayers.
So, who are the Bene Gesserit and how do they relate to Jessica? The first chapter in this book, we get introduced to the Reverend Mother, one of the key leaders of the Bene Gesserit, and we learn that these people are quite intense. They are the ultimate shadow masters. The Sisterhood of the Bene Gesserit are not only trying to manipulate the Imperium and the political mechanisms, they are running the millennium-long genetic... Oh, it's a little bit creepy, I don't like the word. What's the term for it? Selective?
Eugenics?
Yes, eugenics. A eugenics program to breed the perfect warrior. As we mentioned earlier, the Khalazar-Kairak... Oh, gosh.
You can say it, man. You know how to say Kwisatz-Haderach.
Kwisatz-Haderach.
Oh, Duncan, this is genuinely sad. I thought you could say it.
Kwisatz-Haderach.
Kwisatz-Haderach. Listen, I'm not going to make funny for this. Like, I genuinely thought you could do this, but I'm not going to drag it out of you. But yeah, they can create psychic Jesus.
Exactly. And that's what their grand schemes are. They're the ones that we mentioned. They placed their plans on Dune, and Jessica is a member of their order. And when we're introduced to Jessica, we establish a couple of things. One, that she's super concerned for Paul's well-being. You know, she's a loving mother, she loves her son, but also she is beholden to her loyalty to this organization, so much so that she can't protect her son when this organization wants to put him in direct line of danger.
She's twisted in other ways as well, because she's also loyal to House Atreides. She's not married to Duke Leto. She's only his courtesan. No, sorry, his courtesan, his concubine. But she's still an important, valued member of the house. And, you know, they are as close as husband and wife in many ways. He can't marry her because of political complications. He has to keep himself open to other houses so that they can all be friends together. But it's really interesting because the fact that she is unswervingly loyal to the house, even choosing it above her sisterhood, in that she chose to give Count Leto a son instead of a daughter, which she was commanded to, despite all that, she's still suspected as a traitor. And it's criminal that this was not included in the movies, because it's one of the best parts, the way in which other characters don't trust Jessica, a character who is fiendishly clever and spots deception everywhere around her and has to fight for her own place in her own family against Fufir Hawat and later Gurney Halleck.
She's such a representative of a symbol of strength in so many non-direct, like, in a non-physical way. How often do we get a strong character who is just strong in a very traditionally masculine type? You know, they're strong because they wear armor and they wield the sword and they ride the horse. It's nice to see someone who's just got a strong sense of character and a resilience to just the general hardships that they have to go through in sort of surviving this kind of these political mechanisms, but who is also then strong when we see when we get out into the desert later in the book. So,
yeah, she also knows the weirding way, which is sci-fi non-kung fu.
It is also somewhat left out of the films as well.
It's interesting how in Dune Part 2, Jessica is played very differently, and Aaliyah is really different. A character who we have not mentioned up to this point for understandable reasons, because she's just a little bit too weird. But Jessica's really different in the film. Like, she becomes this, like, true fanatic, a true believer in the myth of her own son, Paul. And she's definitely, like, his supporter. She's absolutely on his side, and she wants to help him in his political, religioso machinations. But she doesn't go completely stir-wacko after becoming a reverend mother.
That is one way to put it. But you're right, she still keeps that much stronger sense.
I still like the depiction, though. Like, I think it's good acting and it's good storytelling.
Oh, Rebecca Ferguson, amazing in those two movies.
She did a really
good
job. In fact,
I think it's absolutely... Sorry, personal rant now. She was not part of the marketing for the first movie. It actually really drove me a little bit up the wall how much Zendaya was doing the marketing. I'm like, you're in this film for 5 minutes. I know you're an amazing actor and really popular.
She has four lines.
This is not your film. This is Rebecca Ferguson's film.
Because it's Rebecca Ferguson's first half of the book, Paul is really not that important until past the halfway mark. He flies a plane at one point, and that's basically his main contribution. He's much more passive in the book, where he doesn't really get to make a lot of big decisions. He goes on rides with his dad, and he gets lessons from his teachers. But the person who has real agency and who is fighting for herself and for her family, it is Lady Jessica. She's the protagonist of the first half. Along with, I mean, I guess the family Atreides is sort of like a character in of itself in the first half, but it's Jessica is the main protagonist at that point.
Exactly. And because she dominates the first half of the book, I think you really kind of buy into, even when maybe Paul is being uninteresting or a bit of a dick at times, it's nice to see her...
I wouldn't go that far.
It's nice to see that her, like, no, I love my son, I want to protect him. And when we get to the later stage of the books where it's like, who do I need to protect him most from? It's like, well, his own fanatic followers.
Mm.
It's a really nice... I'm actually struggling to explain this, Georgia, because unlike when we talked about the religion and the allegories and the metaphors, this is what's so nice about Lady Jessica is how twisted it all is in on herself, her character arc. You know, she's trying to give her son protection by getting him in with these followers. At the same time, she's trying to, though, she knows that he needs these followers to be powerful and be safe. At the same time, she's trying to unpick the knot of her religious order. I'm going to refer to the Bene Gesserit as a religious order. Cult might be a better term.
Fair enough.
Her loyalty's there. I like the fact that she is questioned and her very morality is put on the table by characters like Thufir Hawat. And because we've got this omniscient view, we know that she's innocent, like, and that she's a good person and what she's trying to do.
So we feel very defensive and on her side. We're like, hey, don't accuse Jessica.
Don't accuse Jessica. It's and also, like, when Jessica helps steal her scene with Duncan Idaho when he gets drunk. And you just see, like, this is how she just deals with people in a very mundane setting. You know, she's being accused. She's, you know, she has every right to be angry, but she's just like, put him somewhere so he can sleep off the booze. Like, I'm not going to escalate this up to the Duke. Let's just put him to the side. And how she manages a household.
Jessica's a great character, absolutely. Really a standout. You mentioned Zendaya. Zendaya obviously plays Chani. She's Chani in the movie, but to me, she'll always be Chani. She's Chani in the movie, and that's a character that's approached very differently. I think that that's a smart move on the part of the filmmakers. I think they really enhanced the role that Chani plays versus the book. Chani takes on a kind of similar role to Lady Jessica when she shows up, in that she is very supportive. And she's strong in a very obvious physical sense. She fights battles on Paul's behalf. But I don't think she's anywhere near as complete a character as Jessica. And I think that the movie did a good job of, one, twisting the story so that she's, like, opposed to Paul at the end. I think that's really interesting. And it's going to make a Dune Messiah movie watchable, which it wouldn't be otherwise if it was a better adaptation, like a more faithful adaptation. But also just, like, I think Zendaya Chani being much more forthright, oppositional, headstrong, I think it just works better on film. I think it's just a really smart adaptational choice.
I do think I agree with you. I think if you took Chani, actually appears in the book. And Chani is a good character. And, you know, in the sense that she's noble, loving, strong, does right by Paul, even when she might be going to get shafted at points. I like her as a character, but she doesn't have enough. If she was just in the film, as she is in the book, I think you'd almost go, she's forgettable. Or, even more, you'd probably watch it and go,
I agree.
Do you know what? I think you could edit her out, and you wouldn't lose the original Dune. You lose the sequels, but you wouldn't lose the first book.
I think you're 100% right. It's really bizarre. Like, it's crazy that Florence Pugh can show up as Princess Irulan, a character who has one line of actual dialogue. She's in Dune a lot because of her bibliographies and stuff. But she has one actual line of dialogue in a book, and she can show up and be such a bigger impression on the screen than she ever was in the book. And I think that's really fascinating and a new dynamic to throw in. Princess Irulan is not enough of a character in Dune that when she actually shows up again in Dune Messiah, I don't really feel a sense of anticipation to have seen this character who is off in the shadows before, providing a different perspective on Paul and giving context for his largesse later on after the end of the book, that she can show up and be a fully fledged character. But actually, I'm really interested to see Florence Pugh do more stuff as Irulan in the next book. And I really think it's just going to be, I really think the Dune Messiah adaptation, in like when it comes out in 2027, I just think it's going to be really good.
I'm really hoping it's going to be the same, not only for the character you mentioned, Florence Pugh. I love it how we can use actors three times to transition amongst characters, because I'm about to do it again. Because Anya Taylor-Joy had a very small amount of time.
Oh, yeah.
In the second movie, representing the character of Aaliyah. Thank you. Aaliyah. Mostly because she's not in the movies, other than vague future visions.
Smart choice.
This is a character that I think... We're talking about, like... Oh, relating this back to Lady Jessica. Strong female characters, and particularly strong mother characters. Lady Jessica gives birth in this story, and raises a child. And this child is weird.
She is weird. She's very strange. A middle-aged woman... Right, middle. She acts sometimes like a middle-aged woman, but she's actually a several thousand-year-old woman in the body of a two-year-old.
This is one of those things where Dune played with this particular idea. I think it's when I got most disconnected. They play with this a lot in Dune, Children of Dune, and yeah, I think it's one of the reasons why I don't vibe with that
book.
It's
so weird. It's really weird and uncomfortable in Children of Dune. These like 8-year-olds having these weird grown-up conversations. It feels gross. Something wrong with it.
It is really weird. Aaliyah, did I say it right again?
You were close.
Aaliyah. Good. Aaliyah is someone that doesn't appear in the films, is in this book, and is quite a strong impact. I mean, Aaliyah gets the killing blow on the main villain of this story.
Yeah, sorry, Gurney.
But you're right, she got cut out of the film, because I read this, and a bit like Charney, you're like, other than being this kind of weird, I think, to be honest, she does so much to adding that kind of spaced out, I'm going to say, like, hallucinogenic vibe to Dune.
Yep,
totally. Is in this character. And I'll be honest with you, Geordie, it's the bit that I actually dislike most about this book.
That's interesting.
I don't like it because I think it, in a way, it makes... I couldn't work out how to empathize. And I know Aaliyah's meant to be different and inhuman. And I was like, but you're just so weird. I don't know how to feel.
Oh, no. I gotta say, I think it's really interesting the way in which Frank chooses to make you not empathize and not humanize his characters. The more Paul changes this book, the more alien and weird and unlikable he becomes. I love the final scene. I want to talk about that in detail. And I love Paul in the final scene. But Paul is cold and callous and dark and manipulative and reprehensible. And Aaliyah is unsettling. People call her a freak. And she can have a little cry about it all she likes. But I agree. She is a freak. She is an abomination.
Wow, that's harsh, but you know what? When I'm reading this book, I feel the same way.
And I think that's kind of the point. She is unsettling. A 2-year-old murdered a man with a poison needle.
Thing is,
the Emperor is weirdly chill about talking to that child. He never questions it.
Do you ever think the Emperor is just like, I have seen so much at this point. I'm just going to let this
wash. I think he's well cast as
Christopher Walken?
I think he's well cast as Christopher Walken, not because he's like an appropriate actor for that role, but he does have a slightly, oh man, dazed out, like, I'm a little too tired for this kind of look to him. And I think that's appropriate for the Padishah Emperor.
So, Geordi, I don't like Alia. I love Jessica. I'm neutral on Chani. I'm still happy, though, that there's quite this nice diversity. Oh, sorry, something else that was left out of the film, not just to do this as a comparison to the movie. Chani's a mother in this story, in this book.
Oh, yeah. Very understandable to not include that.
It feels like, I'll be honest, even in the book, while there was a moment where, when I first read it, it gave me a bit of an emotional gut punch. So Chani and Paul have a child who sadly is murdered off screen.
Murdered, yeah, by Sadako.
And for me, I don't know if the word is, it feels weird to use this term in this context, but I think like frished. It's like you created this child just to kill it, Frank, so I could get a bit of an emotional, oh my godness. And I think first time it worked, and the second time I just went, oh really?
Yeah, I think you can tell that he really is fridge, because that kid is referred to as Leto the Second. And guess what Paul's next son is called?
Leto the Second.
He's called Leto the Second as well. Why isn't he Leto the Third? It was already Leto the Second. You forgot about him? I don't remember him ever being mentioned in Messiah.
He might not be.
I've read Messiah numerous times. I never remembered him mentioning him.
I always thought that. I always thought calling his third son Leto the Second again, I was just like, not third, second son, Leto the Second. It's like, that is really, wow, you did not care.
One, callous. Two, that name is clearly cursed. It is not going well for the Latos.
I know, I would have gone like, at least Paul. Go on, Paul the Second, Paul Two.
No way, that name's super cursed. It's end way worse for Paul.
Anyway.
I think, rapid fire, let's just hit some more cool stuff from the book.
Okay, Omnithopters are really cool.
Ornithopters, yes. So, in the movie, they're displayed as, like, being dragonflies. They have, like, quad wings that fly. But in the book, they are ornithopters, as in ornithology. They have bird wings.
They are. And I know maybe there's an argument for physics, which also plays right into our fantasy argument, that this makes slightly less sense than the dragonfly look we get in the movies.
That's you as an engineer.
But it's such a cool idea. It's a great way of having this both high-tech, low-tech sense of our society.
On a related note, the shield fights.
Great concept. How do you justify sword fighting in your sci-fi world? The shield is an amazing invention. And when I've seen people break down like lightsabers and go, excuse me, push up glasses, like that's not how you would actually fight with a weapon like that. When people try and break down the shields, I think most people do go, yeah, all right. Yeah, that justifies it.
Yeah, and a great thing is, there's this one guy, he's one of those people who like talks about sword fighting but doesn't actually fight with a sword. He just owns swords, which he hits cardboard boxes with, and then acts like he knows what he's talking about. So, And he was talking about how, like, why don't people in Dune who fight with shields just, like, run hard at each other? Because if you run at someone really fast, you give any blow they give to you kinetic energy, which then, like, would dissipate against your shield. And I stood there and I just went, well, obviously you just move your sword backwards. And wouldn't that be great? There's a martial arts about where you stab backwards. You move your sword hand back at half the speed your opponent approaches and they slide onto your sword. Isn't that so cool?
That is absolutely amazing. And it's even addressed, you know, the ramming into them to activate your shield is something that's addressed in the books. There are scenes where if someone's coming in at you, you just whack it with your arm really hard to knock the blade. Because then your shield will definitely activate.
I wish that this idea wasn't so connected to Dune, because people should just steal this all the time. This should be so ubiquitous that it should be in tons of different sci-fi stories.
The only thing I think I look at this and go, okay, cool, is that no one combines this with just more, at least not that I could pick up, like just more conventional armor as well. You have your
there's no point, because the shield is such a good defense.
Yeah, but then if you're wearing armor that a slow moving blade can't punch through, that doesn't have enough inertia behind it, then you basically have doubled up and you're now immortal. Not immortal, you get my point.
I guess that's true. It's sort of like the whole wizards in armor argument. Like, wizards should just be allowed to use it. I guess there might be real, maybe like weapons in Dune are so sharp that conventional armor just doesn't work on them.
That's the only thing I can think of. And if you're in a universe where shields do exist, why wouldn't the next like technological developments just be in upgrading how sharp you can make a blade? Like, that would be the new focus.
Talking about shield fighting, I want to talk about Fade Ralpha, presented as Gladiator. I mentioned this to you in the middle of the week, and because I'd never noticed this, despite it being my fifth read through of this book. At a certain point in this book, Paul kills his first man, Jameis, and then he spends the rest of that chapter kind of agonizing over the fact that he's just killed his first man. And the next chapter is Jameis's funeral, and Paul cries over Jameis, and he talks about what he's learned from Jameis, and then they take him along to steal his water because the Fremen are kind of cannibals. And then the next chapter begins with this. On his 17th birthday, Fade Ralpha Harkonnen killed his 100th slave gladiator in the family games.
Brilliant dichotomy between the two characters.
That's fantastic. Good job, Frank. You wrote a really cutting, good sentence in your sci-fi masterpiece.
One of very many. And an excellent introduction to the character of Faye Ruthal as well, who appears in the final chapter. But just before we get there, I just want to throw one little thing out there. Duncan Idaho, in this first book, God, I forgot how small a role he has compared to what he has in the rest of the series.
Yeah, for sure. I once did a little quiz online that was like, guess the most named people in the Dune series. And number one is Duncan Idaho, beating out even Paul.
He is essentially the protagonist from, I would argue, he's a dual protagonist in book 3, and he is essentially the protagonist for books 4, 5, and 6.
But yeah, he's mostly talked about abstractly. I don't want to move on from Fade Ralpha just yet. I brought him up not to talk about that one line, even though it's a great one. I brought it up because Fade Ralpha has this scene fighting against an Atreides gladiator in the games, and there's this really massive shift in how this is depicted in the movies versus the book, and I think it really encapsulates everything about the movie as opposed to the book, and how it simplifies a complicated story for the mass audiences. And in the movie, this is done by Count Vladimir Harkonnen, and he's basically testing his nephew. He's saying, are you cool enough to replace me at the top of Count Harkonnen? Can I choose you over Raban, your elder? And he defeats him, but he also like demonstrates this like evil sportsmanship. Like, he like throws away his own shield and he fights him man on man. But in the books, one, he cheats. It's Fade Ralpha's idea. He doesn't drug the slave. And then he fights a man on man, but he cheats to do it because he can't actually win in a fair fight. He like has multiple levels of cheating, in fact. But this is actually part of a longer scheme, which is to get the slave master of House Harkonnen like assassinated for screwing up this job. And he does this so that later he can hatch a plot to plant this poison needle on a slave to kill his uncle, so that he can become head of the house. And all of this is dreamed up by Fufir Hawat, who not only comes up with these ideas, but also undoes all of them, because he tells Vladimir Harkonnen about this plot to get on his good side. So there's this incredibly intricate game of mental cat and mouse between uncle and nephew and semi-traitor Fufir Hawat. It's complicated. He's a nuanced character. All just to demonstrate why these people are like mentally dangerous, as opposed to the movie, which just wants to tell you Fade Ralpha is good at fighting with a knife, so that when he fights Paul at the end, he's extra scary.
I mean, brilliantly kind of put together. Yes, and it's a really great scene to show you that these people, one, are very evil, and
very evil,
are schemers. And it's not, and that's kind of goes back to the Bene Gesserit and the Emperor and everything. It's what you need to fear in the Dune universe are the schemers above all. And even though Paul is sort of like gaining the throne and he wants to just smash the system and have the strength of his armies, it's sort of like, well, yeah, he has all of that now, but there are still schemes going on to bring him down, and that's still always going to be a threat.
Okay. There's so much stuff we could talk about. Like, I would love to talk about how Seleucus Secundus and the Sardaukar is never even explicitly spelled out in the books, like, what they are. It's just hinted at, and you just have to pay attention and read between the lines, and it would be so easy to miss. But I'm not going to talk about that. Let's just talk about the final scene, because I love the final scene in Dune. I think it's one of the best chapters in any fantasy novel.
I'm not necessarily going to disagree with you, particularly the final line. I think it's such a interesting and basically, well, inspired choice to have that be the note you end this series, well, the series, this first book on. So, Geordie, take us away. What's so amazing?
I mean, there's got to be... you talked about the final line. There's so many amazing lines in this section. I'd love to bring one up. Let's have a look. So, don't try your powers on me. Try looking into that place where you dare not look. You'll find me staring back at you.
Such a good threat.
It's so good. And it doesn't make any sense unless you've read in. But yes, it's great. It's a way of saying, like, I am the Kwisatz Haderach without saying I am the Kwisatz Haderach. You just have to read into it. And there's this amazing line, which I've used a weird number of times in my life, which is, he who has the power to destroy that thing controls that thing utterly.
And again, so how often do you use that in your life?
A weird amount of times. I don't know why it keeps coming up, but I can quote it in my life for some reason.
But a wonderful sentiment. You know, the person who can sit there with their finger physically over the nuclear button basically controls society.
Exactly. And the way this is spelt out is that Paul, because the Fremen have such control over spice, and they've ruined the Harkonnen's power to control spice, they have the power, using the water of life, to just pour it out on the spice fields and destroy it. And mean that there is no way to get spice. They can destroy all the sandworms. And that means there's no spice. And that means there's no spacing guild. And that means there's no traveling between planets. And this changes everything. Because in this final scene, nothing matters. Confronting the Emperor doesn't matter. Confronting the Bene Gesserit doesn't matter. Killing the last of a Harkonnen doesn't matter. All that matters is controlling the Spacing Guild. He can ignore everyone else. Everything else is done out of spite. He even says, I might do this thing out of spice or mere ennui. Oh, it's so good.
It's true. Well, it kind of goes to the seat of the Emperor itself. The idea is the fact that, oh, he rules. He doesn't rule. He's just like everyone else. Without the Spacing Guild, he sits on his little throne in his little palace on one planet.
Exactly.
And Geordie, oh, I love it.
But the final line, Duncan, you handle this one. This is after Paul has killed Fade Ralpha, which again, he does just because he wants to. The guy challenged him, but he did not have to fight back. He could have easily just like gotten Gurney to kill him for him, or just had his Fedaiken fall on him and kill all of them if he wanted to, but it's just a demonstration of his power. But after that, he kills Fade Ralpha, and he gets the Emperor to agree, and Princess Irulan, she explicitly consents, and that's nice. That's nice. She agrees to be his wife, to give him, like, official legal power to be the new
Such
emperor.
A small detail.
And this is obviously upsetting for Chaney, because they're not married. Fremen don't really seem to get married. She refers to him as his mate. But she's obviously, like, bummed about being cuckolded.
But instead of wandering off onto the desert to call a worm, instead, she turns to Jessica, who has gone through so much in this story, who herself was never the wife of Duke Leto the First, but that doesn't make her any less Paul's mother and the mother to the Emperor. And she turns to Chaney and goes, you know, they may He may be marrying Princess Irulan, but we, Chaney, we who carry the name of concubine, here she will call us wives.
And that's great. Isn't it interesting that this whole book doesn't end with Paul making a declaration about what he's going to do when he's on the throne? It ends with Jessica and Chaney. It ends with Jessica signaling her own power to say, despite the fact that I was never permitted to be a true member of House Atreides, despite the fact that I was never given the respect I deserved, history will remember me as one of the most important women in all of existence.
And it obviously feeds into the earlier point with Paul. You know, the fact that he's just trying to become the emperor at this point because he can. It's sort of just a reminder to Chaney. It's like, it doesn't matter what titles are heaped upon you. That is empty words. It's what you'll actually do. And it's sort of, I think, a lovely bit. Once it's empowerment for Jessica and for Chaney. And it's also just this lovely little point with Chaney to be like, that man over there has just crowned himself emperor. He is seen as the Messiah. He is like the most powerful being in the universe. And you will have the single most influence over him than anyone else.
Mm.
So take that for what it is.
And you're going to be in so many other books.
Yes, yes, that's exactly what happens. But no spoilers there, Geordie. Not until we one day pick up on the sequel. But who knows when?
To be honest, I don't think that's going to happen. As much as I think Messiah is a really interesting book, I feel like most of the stuff we've got to say about it, I think we probably kind of covered in this one, right?
Completely. I think it also has a really great ending.
It does. And I like the opening chapters as well, where they talk about the jihad. Like, you get to hear from, like, a guy who went on it and, like, seeing an ocean for the first time. That's a great chapter. It's worth reading just for that. But we don't need to get into Zombie, Duncan Idaho, and 17-year-old naked Aaliyah fighting a sword mannequin.
Let's not.
We don't need to get into any of that. Face dancers, Telaxu,
all Axians. Elements that's like, wow, these are not in the first book, or barely. So, Geordie, June, did you like it?
I loved it.
I love it too.
I've read it through so many times that I read it through this time just out of like being like, I should. I probably didn't need to watch Lawrence Arabia. I didn't end up talking about that movie anywhere near as much as I was expecting to when I was preparing for this episode, but I'm still glad I did it because it's good.
That is a great movie. Watch it in two parts.
It makes you appreciate Lemonade more than you ever thought you would.
I love this book too. Geordie, who do you recommend this to? Is it everyone?
Yeah, it is everyone actually, because I think that if you just really muscle through, I think that it's a huge swath of people who can enjoy this book. If you're someone, you know, unless you're someone who, like, you know, you're not a strong reader, and that's totally fine. There's much more accessible books out there. But if you are someone who enjoys reading, even if you don't normally read science fiction, I gave this book to my dad. He does not read sci-fi, but he is making his way through, and he doesn't need too much help from me. I did have to make him reread chapter 2 because he missed it somehow. He didn't realize, to be fair, there aren't actual chapter titles in this book, but he did just miss chapter 2 and I had to make him go back and read it. But anyway, yeah. Read this book. It's amazing.
I suppose I must stand in the same boat. I know it won't be for everyone, but I do recommend everyone to try it. I, in my experience, reading a lot of fantasy literature, in the very same way that I put Lord of the Rings as the tip of the pyramid, you know, everything else is, did you like that? Well, you might like this. They're all lesser, or in its shadow, or a form of, and it's trickled down. Dune is that for the science fantasy fiction, damn it, genre.
You can say fiction. I know, it's really tempting to say it, because it is, listen, it is science fiction. There's no getting away from that. It just so happens that we found a loophole that we can talk about it.
It has such an impact, and it's one of those ones where I go, it's like when you watch a great TV show you love on Netflix and they'll be recommended and you'll click a recommended and you'll find another recommended and you'll click until eventually you get to rubbish. Dune is like the best starting place. If you like Dune, read it and then you'll be able to go and find something else that's like it and then something else and something else and something else. This is what a great starting point. And particularly now, I'd say I recommend everyone to try it, and every person that walked out of the cinema having seen the most recent adaptation and enjoyed it, dear God, you owe it to yourself to try it. Be it
absolutely.
In physical book
just
form or audio
book. Read it and experience. Yeah. The audiobook is amazing. Apparently there's a missing scene though, so I don't know what to say about that. But I've always enjoyed the audiobook. If you enjoyed the film, absolutely read the book. You're just going to have a better experience. And you had like the Cliff Notes version. You've been helped. You'll know what a Mentat is, and that will help you. So yeah, if you enjoyed the film, go see it. If you don't struggle immensely reading, go see it. If you aren't J.R.R. Tolkien, who hated this book, go ahead and read it. Yeah.
So that's our recommendations, but let us know what you think about Dune. If you've read the book or just seen the most recent movies, reach out to us, tell us your thoughts, tell us if you think we're wrong for doing it on a fantasy podcast. The best place to tell us how wrong we are is at the It's Just a Fantasy Podcast Instagram account. It's also where you get the most latest updates when a new episode drops. And also, if you enjoyed this episode or any of our previous episodes, do go and give us a nice 5-star rating. It does do an awful lot to share it with the many other people. Well, Geordie.
And tell us your Dune name. Are you Jonathan Maine? Are you Susan California? We want to know.
I know, I can't believe at the beginning I referred to calling myself Duncan Idaho as a joke and not a reference. Well, I am very confident. So, Geordie, we've done it. Dune has been read.
We did it.
What's next?
You tell me, man. It's your choice.
I have been thinking, and I'm thinking, where do I want to go? What's the next piece of the puzzle? And I'm looking at the shelf. I'm thinking, I want something, but I want something different. But I want something that's genre defining. But I've read so many of the big ones. You know, who or what do I need to read next? And I just suddenly I saw it on a table in my local library. It was they had a new little section in my library. It's called like Fantasy First. Great idea, where they get loads of copies of the first book of fantasy series in, because you can never find the first book in the series in a library. And I was looking at that table.
That's true.
And I saw it and I went, that's the one. That's what we need to read. So, Geordie, I have picked for us, by Stephen King, The Gunslinger, the first in the Dark Tower series.
Ah. Oh, good. Okay, this is gonna be a really big change. I read through... This is going to be weird, because I read through The Stand just like a couple of months ago, so I'm going to be really brushed up on this. I'm going to know who the bad guy is all the way through.
Well, I'm certainly not going to know that much. I've only read about one Stephen King book before, and that was The Shining, which I think is completely unrelated. So I'm very excited to give this a go. And not only that, but Geordie, when I put it next to my Dune book, I realised it's a hell of a lot shorter, and I think I need a little respite.
I can't believe it's shorter, because Stephen King is known for writing slightly bloated books. Again, I finished The Stand a couple of weeks ago, and I think that's like 2 Dunes.
Well, I'm excited to explore it with you, Geordie. You as a Stephen King master, me as a newbie. Let's see what take we have.
I've read double the number of Stephen King books as you, so yes, I am a master.
Till next time, Geordie.
Till next time. So long.
Bye.